Good evening, good morning, hello, our last Sunday together in 2015, and we continue in Sri Aurobindo's large chapter, Brahman Purusha Ishwara, Maya Prakriti Shakti. Sri Aurobindo has pointed out, utilizing the famous analogy of the elephant and the blind man, how the limited intelligence of the human and of the mind cannot take in the entirety of what is the divine reality. It grabs at a part and finds the part sufficient. The infinite consciousness, which is also an infinite will, has a grand purpose and need not act in accordance with the limitations of the mind. He said, the last sentence of the final paragraph that we covered last week, a whole knowledge must be there, and the reason must become plastic enough to look at all sides, all aspects, and seek through them for that in which they are one. So it's an invitation that he's left us with for the mind to rise to a higher plane, to expand its boundaries, to try to take in more of the infinite potential that is the divine, and not to rest so insecurely on the appearances of the universe. So we continue now. Thus too, if we see only the aspect of self, we may concentrate on its static silence and miss the dynamic truth of the infinite. If we see only the Ishvara, we may seize the dynamic truth, but miss the eternal status and the infinite silence, become aware of only dynamic being, dynamic consciousness, dynamic delight of being, but miss the pure existence, pure consciousness, pure bliss of being. If we concentrate on Purusha Prakriti alone, we may see only the dichotomy of soul and nature, spirit and matter, and miss their unity. In considering the action of the infinite, we have to avoid the error of the disciple who thought of himself as the Brahman, refused to obey the warning of the elephant driver to budge from the narrow path, and was taken up by the elephant's trunk and removed out of the way. You are, no doubt, the Brahman, said the master to his bewildered disciple. But why did you not obey the driver Brahman and get out of the path of the elephant Brahman? We must not commit the mistake of emphasizing one side of the truth and concluding from it or acting upon it to the exclusion of all other sides and aspects of the infinite. So these three poises of the divine being as the self, the essential being, Brahman, or as Ishvara, the Lord of all who manifests and holds all that is extant in creation within his own being, self, the many, all within the one person who is cosmic and also transcendent to cosmos, or Purusha Prakriti, the soul watching nature. All three of these are aspects of this supreme being, Satchit Ananda. None of them is alone descriptive of that. Even all three added together, Sri Aurobindo will tell us, is not fully definitive of that, because it remains free of all determinations, negative or positive. It is ever free even of its own statement that I am. Well, let us move forward. The realization, I am that, is true, but we cannot safely proceed on it unless we realize also that all is that, that all is that. So we can say, Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Or we can say, Tattvam Asi, that you are, in the Chandogya Upanishad. But we must also recognize that the larger collectivity also is that same reality. If it is simply a subjective realization, then we have not got the entirety of what is in the Supreme Manifestation. Our self-existence is a fact, he writes, but we must also be aware of other selves, of the same self in other beings, and of that which exceeds both own self and other self. The infinite is one in a multiplicity, and its action is only seizable by a supreme reason which regards all and acts as a one awareness that observes itself in difference and respects its own differences, so that each thing and each being has its form of essential being and its form of dynamic nature, swarupa, swadharma, and all are respected in the total working. So we see here an immense balance between the one and the multiplicity which coheres within it. Its essentiality, also its dynamic expression, both in form and in nature of becoming, nature of expression. The knowledge and action of the infinite is one in an unbound variability. It would be, from the point of view of the infinite truth, equally an error to insist either on a sameness of action in all circumstances, or on a diversity of action without any unifying truth and harmony behind the diversity. In our own principle of conduct, if we sought to act in this greater truth, it would be equally an error to insist on ourself alone, or to insist on other selves alone. It is the self of all on which we have to found a unity of action, and a total, infinitely plastic, yet harmonious diversity of action, for that is the nature of the working of the infinite. So we cannot sublate ourself in the service of the all around us, nor can we eschew the reality of the all around us and focus only on ourselves. There is a context in which we live and move. The self is an expression of a universal self, which is itself a denotation of a supreme self, which itself cannot be captured even as itself. So we must grow individually to embrace and recognize and live within this gigantic reality, which is all, which is the core of our own being, and which exceeds the all that we meet in the universe. So we are essentially pursuing, if we try to make these truths dynamic in ourselves, several yogas at one and the same time, looking for union with the divine consciously and dynamically in all these aspects. If we look from this viewpoint of a larger, more plastic reason, taking account of the logic of the infinite, at the difficulties which meet our intelligence when it tries to conceive the absolute and omnipresent reality, we shall see that the whole difficulty is verbal and conceptual and not real. Our intelligence looks at its concept of the absolute and sees that it must be indeterminable. And at the same time, it sees a world of determinations which emanates from the absolute and exists in it, for it can emanate from nowhere else and can exist nowhere else. It is further baffled by the affirmation, also hardly disputable on the premises, that all these determinants are nothing else than this very indeterminable absolute. So all formations must exist within the absolute. But the contradiction disappears when we understand that the indeterminability is not in its true sense negative, not an imposition of incapacity on the infinite, but positive, a freedom within itself from limitation by its own determinations, and necessarily a freedom from all external determination by anything not itself, since there is no real possibility of such a not-self coming into existence. So, it remains free from identification, full absorption, though it's fully supporting all that it manifests within itself. Its freedom is absolute, just as it is absolute. So it's free from its own determinations. But nothing can impose upon it from outside, because nothing exists outside it. There is no other who could, in a sense, defeat it in a wrestling match and say, you must do it in this way. That is an impossibility. It is the only existence. The infinite, he writes, is illimitably free, free to determine itself infinitely, free from all restraining effect of its own creations. So it can throw all of this out, reside within it, have all of that reside within itself, and yet be free, utterly unencumbered by its manifestation. And here, an important point. In fact, the infinite does not create. It manifests what is in itself, in its own essence of reality. It is itself that essence of all reality, and all realities are powers of that one reality. It doesn't create, it manifests. Create from creare in Latin, which means to beget, produce, to create, to bring into being or to bring into form out of nothing, is the way it's generally understood. Creatio ex nihilo in Latin. The creation comes out of nothing. And this is a common theistic idea. But for Sri Aurobindo, he says, no, it is not a creation. It is a manifestation. And manifestus comes from manus, meaning hand, and festus from fendere, meaning to strike or dash against. So when you manifest something, you make it clear, you make it stand out, you make it so that it is easily seen. So, in a sense, always it was there, but now it comes into view. That's what becomes manifest about it. So this idea is one connected to the emanation of a divine nature, where a creation is a creation out of nothing, a manifestation is within the divine nature and then made clear that it's there. So the absolute, Sri Aurobindo writes, neither creates nor is created in the current sense of making or being made. We can speak of creation only in the sense of the being becoming in form and movement what it already is in substance and status. In other words, we give it a place and a space and a form in which it can move in the shape of the universe. It can move within these borders. That's a determination, isn't it? A determination is a bounded, finite, existing within the unencumbered infinite. Yet, we have to emphasize its indeterminability in that special and positive sense, not as a negation, but as an indispensable condition of its free, infinite self-determination, because without that, the reality would be a fixed, eternal determinate, or else an indeterminate, fixed and bound to a sum of possibilities of determination inherent within it. Its freedom from all limitation, from any binding by its own creation, cannot be itself turned into a limitation, an absolute incapacity, a denial of all freedom of self-determination. It is this that would be a contradiction. It would be an attempt to define and limit by negation the infinite and illimitable. Into the central fact of the two sides of the nature of the absolute, the essential and the self-creative or dynamic, no real contradiction enters. It is only a pure infinite essence that can formulate itself in infinite ways. One statement is complementary to the other. There is no mutual cancellation, no incompatibility. It is only the dual statement of a single inescapable fact by human reason and human language. So there's an infinite essence of being, ever free, that freely manifests, that can enter into determinations because it is within its power to do it. They are all self-determinations, and yet entering into them, it is not bound by them. It remains free. Free in its indeterminability, which is a positive thing, not a negative thing. It's not caught in it. Moving on. The same conciliation, or reconciling agreement, occurs everywhere when we look with a straight and accurate look on the truth of the reality. In our experience of it, we become aware of an infinite, essentially free from all limitation by qualities, properties, features. On the other hand, we are aware of an infinite teeming with innumerable qualities, properties, features. So it's free from all qualities, at the same time it enters into all qualities. Look at the thrust of what he's saying. A straight and accurate look on the truth of the reality. So again, he regards the universe, all that moves, as an expression of this consciousness. Will is intentional, freely determined, and real. There is a truth in the manifestation. It is not elusive. Illusive, not elusive. Here again, the statement of illimitable freedom is positive, not negative. It does not negate what we see, but on the contrary, provides the indispensable condition for it. It makes possible a free and infinite self-expression in quality and feature. A quality is the character of a power of conscious being. Or we may say that the consciousness of being, expressing what is in it, makes the power it brings out recognizable by a native stamp on it, which we call quality or character. So this great conscious being, Satchit-Ananda, which is a person if we like to think of it that way, brings through its power of manifestation well, not just one power, but empowers many different forces, and each one of them confers a quality on its expression, and that becomes the nature of a character in dynamic display. He continues, courage, he illustrates it, I should say. Courage as a quality is such a power of being. It is a certain character of my consciousness expressing a formulated force of my being, bringing out or creating a definite kind of force of my nature and action. So too, the power of a drug to cure is its property, a special force of being native to the herb or mineral from which it is produced, and this speciality is determined by the real ideal concealed in the involved consciousness which dwells in the plant or mineral. The idea brings out in it what was there at the root of its manifestation and has now come out thus empowered as the force of its being. All qualities, properties, features are such powers of conscious being thus put forth from itself by the Absolute. It has everything within it. It has the free power to put all forth. Yet we cannot define the Absolute as a quality of courage or a power of healing. We cannot even say that these are a characteristic feature of the Absolute, nor can we make up a sum of qualities and say that is the Absolute. But neither can we speak of the Absolute as a pure blank incapable of manifesting these things. On the contrary, all capacity is there. The powers of all qualities and characters are there inherent within it. The mind is in a difficulty because it has to say, the Absolute or Infinite is none of these things. These things are not the Absolute or Infinite. And at the same time, it has to say, the Absolute is all these things. They are not something else than that, for that is the sole existence and the all existence. Neti neti, not this, not that. Or, but it is this, it is that also. Neither is exclusively true. They must coexist. The mind explodes. It cannot recognize these two realities being placed in one sentence as being valid. To the mind, it is irreconcilable. To back up for a moment, too, the free power to put all forth. M.P. Pundit, when he commented on the law of divine, pointed out that this idea of creation, of making something, would have, to use the verb kr, K-R with a dot under it, to make. But what we see expressed here is the Sanskrit equivalent as srj, S-R with a dot under it, J, which then arrives at the word srishti, which means the power of projection or loosing forth a reality, sort of saying, go play, allowing all of its forces to move out into expression. So this is the difference in the idea of what manifestation is. It's a loosing forth of the infinite into expressed dynamic movement. Back to the Absolute is all these things. They are not something else than that, for that is the sole existence and the all existence. Here, it is evident that it is an undue finiteness of thought conception and verbal expression which creates the difficulty, but there is in reality none. In other words, it is the structure of the mental language reflecting the nature of the divided consciousness of the intellect that presents us with this contradiction. In reality, we don't really find that it obtains. For it would be evidently absurd to say that the absolute is courage or curing power, or to say that courage and curing power are the absolute. But it would be equally absurd to deny the capacity of the absolute to put forth courage or curing power as self-expressions in its manifestation. When the logic of the finite fails us, we have to see with a direct and unbound vision what is behind in the logic of the infinite. We can then realize that the infinite is infinite in quality, feature, power, but that no sum of qualities, features, powers can describe the infinite, because it is inherently greater. You can't sum it up. You cannot run a mathematical score on it and say, finally, I've reached the end, and this is what is the absolute. It is something more. It is something beyond. We see that the absolute, the self, the divine, the spirit, the being is one. The transcendental is one. The cosmic is one. But we see also that beings are many, and each has a self, a spirit, a like yet different nature. And since the spirit and essence of things is one, we are obliged to admit that all these many must be that one. And it follows that the one is or has become many. But how can the limited or relative be the absolute? And how can man or beast or bird be the divine being? But in erecting this apparent contradiction, the mind makes a double error. It is thinking in the terms of the mathematical finite unit, which is soul and limitation, the one which is less than two and can become two only by division and fragmentation, or by addition and multiplication. But this is an infinite oneness. It is the essential and infinite oneness which can contain the hundred and the thousand and the million and billion and trillion. So the one is not a mathematical one. It is not arithmetic that the divine does when it says, I am one. Whatever astronomic or more than astronomic figures you heap and multiply, they cannot overpass or exceed that oneness, for in the language of the Upanishad, it moves not, yet is always far in front when you would pursue and seize it. This is Isha Upanishad, verse 5. It can be said of it that it would not be the infinite oneness if it were not capable of an infinite multiplicity. But that does not mean that the one is plural or can be limited or described as the sum of the many. On the contrary, it can be the infinite many because it exceeds all limitation or description by multiplicity and exceeds at the same time all limitation by finite conceptual oneness. Pluralism is an error because, though there is the spiritual plurality, the many souls are dependent and interdependent existences. Their sum also is not the one, nor is it the cosmic totality. They depend on the one and exist by its oneness. Yet the plurality is not unreal. It is the one soul that dwells as the individual in these many souls, and they are eternal in the one and by the one eternal. This is difficult for the mental reason, which makes an opposition between the infinite and the finite, and associates finiteness with plurality, and infinity with oneness. But in the logic of the infinite, there is no such opposition, and the eternity of the many in the one is a thing that is perfectly natural and possible. Underscore that, and you find therein yet another confirmation that what is essentially true in you and expresses itself as your soul is an eternal reality and resides always in the Supreme, whether there is a universe or whether it is no universe. You are. Again, we see that there is an infinite pure status and immobile silence of the Spirit, and immobile silence of the Spirit. We see, too, that there is a boundless movement of the Spirit, a power, a dynamic, spiritual, all-containing self-extension of the infinite. So there is that self, silent, immaculate, unmoved, unmoving. But there is also a dynamic spiritual expression of the infinite. Our conceptions, foist upon this perception, in itself valid and accurate, an opposition between the silence and status and the dynamis and movement. But to the reason and logic of the infinite, there can be no such opposition. So we see the silent sage, the sannyasi, sitting on one side and saying, only this frozen silence of the Absolute is real. And on the other side, we see Krishna dancing in creation, saying, that has entered into this, and all of this is my playground. There is no opposition to the divine view. A solely silent and static infinite, an infinite without an infinite power and dynamis and energy, is inadmissible except as the perception of an aspect. A powerless absolute, an impotent spirit, is unthinkable. An infinite energy must be the dynamis of the infinite, and all power must be the potency of the absolute. An illimitable force must be the force of the spirit. So, in other words, what throws out this universe is real, is a reality, and is a power that is contained within the absolute, and it has full authority to express itself thus. But the silence, he continues, the status are the basis of the movement. So yes to the silence, yes to the absolute. An eternal immobility is the necessary condition, field, essence even, of the infinite mobility. A stable being is the condition and foundation of the vast action of the force of being. You remember Sri Aurobindo's savitri. In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power. It is when we arrive at something of this silence, stability, immobility, that we can base on it a force and energy which in our superficial restless state would be inconceivable. The opposition we make is mental and conceptual. In reality, the silence of the Spirit and the dynamis of the Spirit are complementary truths and inseparable. The immutable, silent Spirit may hold its infinite energy silent and immobile within it, for it is not bound by its own forces, is not their subject or instrument, but it does possess them, does release them, is capable of an eternal and infinite action, does not weary or need to stop, and yet all the time its silent immobility inherent in its action and movement is not for a moment shaken or disturbed or altered by its action and movement. The witness silence of the Spirit is there in the very grain of all the voices and workings of nature. These things may be difficult for us to understand, because our own surface finite capacity in either direction is limited, and our conceptions are based on our limitations. But it should be easy to see that these relative and finite conceptions do not apply to the absolute and infinite. Reason's logic cannot resolve or even see the vastness that contains and exceeds these contradictions. They're contradictions only to logic. And this statement of what is the view of an immutable silent spirit that can embrace and become all of this movement, and in a way that leaves the inmost being unshaken, just as when Nataraj dances, his eyes are ever closed, seated in bliss, indrawn, drawing out into expressive dance the infinite consciousness and energy that lies within him. This is echoed in the Bhagavad Gita, and this is seen as a constant fact in Sri Aurobindo's own personal experience. He was that. Like the Himalayas, he sat, and yet ever creative. He seemed to be silent, seemed to be static. His mind did not waver, and yet he writes nearly 24,000 lines of blank verse in this magnificent epic, which we are fortunate to read at the close of each of our meetings, Savitri. I think that leads me to read from Savitri. So this is our last meeting of 2015. When next we meet, it will be early January in 2016. So I wish you a bonne année in advance. We read tonight from the Book of the Divine Mother. This is Canto 2 in Book 3, The Adoration of the Divine Mother, the opening section of it. A stillness absolute, incommunicable, meets the sheer self-discovery of the soul. A wall of stillness shuts it from the world. A gulf of stillness swallows up the sense and makes unreal all that mind has known, all that the laboring senses still would weave, prolonging an imaged unreality. Self's vast spiritual silence occupies space. Only the inconceivable is left, only the nameless without space and time. Abolished is the burdening need of life. Thought falls from us, we cease from joy and grief. The ego is dead, we are freed from being and care. We have done with birth and death and work and fate. O soul, it is too early to rejoice. Thou hast reached the boundless silence of the self. Thou hast leaped into a glad divine abyss. But where hast thou thrown self's mission and self's power? On what dead bank on the eternal's road? One was within thee who was self and world. What hast thou done for his purpose in the stars? Escape brings not the victory and the crown. something thou cam'st to do from the unknown, but nothing is finished, and the world goes on because only half God's cosmic work is done. Only the everlasting know has neared, and stared into thy eyes, and killed thy heart. But where is the lover's everlasting yes, and immortality in the secret heart, the voice that chants to the Creator fire, the symboled Om, the great assenting word, the bridge between the rapture and the calm, the passion and the beauty of the bride, the chamber where the glorious enemies kiss, the smile that saves, the golden peak of things. This too is truth at the mystic fount of life. A black veil has been lifted. We have seen the mighty shadow of the omniscient Lord. But who has lifted up the veil of light, and who has seen the body of the King? The mystery of God's birth and acts remains, leaving unbroken the last chapter's seal, unsolved the riddle of the unfinished play. The cosmic player laughs within his mask, and still the last inviolate secret hides behind the human glory of a form, behind the gold eidolon of a name. A large white line has figured as a goal, but far beyond the ineffable sun tracks blaze. What seemed the source and end was a wide gate, a last bare step into eternity. An eye has opened upon timelessness. Infinity takes back the forms it gave, and through God's darkness or his naked light, his million rays return into the sun. There is a zero sign of the supreme. Nature left nude and still uncovers God. But in her grandiose nothingness, all is there. When her strong garbs are torn away from us, the soul's ignorance is slain, but not the soul. The zero covers an immortal face. A high and blank negation is not all. A huge extinction is not God's last word, life's ultimate sense, the close of being's course, the meaning of this great mysterious world. In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power. Awaking, it can wake the trance-bound soul, and in the ray reveal the parent sun. It can make the world a vessel of spirit's force. It can fashion in the clay God's perfect shape. To free the self is but one radiant pace. Here to fulfill himself was God's desire. So, Namaste, Jai Ma.